Hey, sit down listeners. You can find us every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Here's a little real estate reality from me, a Century 21 affiliated agent. Looking for your perfect home? You should look for your perfect agent first. Most people spend more time picking a restaurant than a real estate agent. That's why we encourage you to browse through ratings and reviews on Century21.com so you can find an agent who will put 121% of their effort into finding your next home. Century 21, move fearlessly. Each office is independently owned and operated. Century 21 is a registered trademark owned by Century 21 Real Estate, LLC.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? And welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, back and better than ever. Another episode, another week, another sit down. We got a great episode planned for you today, as always. I hope you're having a great week. It is another hot summer week. And we're getting closer and closer to fall. It's always nice by this point. You're starting to look forward a little bit to fall, right? Super hot out. I know this week it's like 90 degrees. It's the dog days of summer. But we continue to rock here on the show off a fun episode last week. We've had a couple of good ones recently. We obviously had the big one with Marcello a couple of weeks ago. Talked about Bobby Manna, did a little Q&A last week. We've got a huge show planned for you today. And I've been wanting to do this one for a while. We have occasionally on this show discussed drug traffickers. We've discussed mafia drug traffickers. We've discussed Kabani Savage. We've talked about Frank Matthews, Benny Ong, and the Asian community. Today, we're going to talk about arguably the most effective drug trafficker in the history of this country. We're going to talk about Griselda Blanco. And I know a lot of people have heard the name Griselda, whether it was in rap music or through a television show or whatever. We're going to go through the whole story of La Madrina, basically the true godmother of cocaine, an individual that really transformed the cocaine drug trade in this country. She was the first of her kind to really create a route from South America into the United States. And she hit it at the right time. The cocaine boom in the 70s was evident. In the early 80s, Miami was a hellscape. We're going to talk about that. We can basically credit Griselda Blanco with probably in this country, hundreds of murders. She had a very successful and lucrative assassin group that killed for her. She killed by any means necessary. And we're going to talk about her wild story today. Before we get into that, as always, I want to go through a little bit of housekeeping. As if you always, if you enjoy the show, please make sure you leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the show. What can we do better? What can we improve on? It's always important that we take constructive criticism. If you want to voice your concerns or your successes, please hit me up on Twitter at sitdown7. And that's where a lot of you can get involved. People ask about the Q&As or they have a question on something. You can reach out to me at sitdown7. And if you enjoy the content we throw out here each week from a biography standpoint, we do a lot of content as well on YouTube. Please go check that out. You can find us on YouTube really just by searching The Sit Down, a Mafia History podcast in your search bar. We're very close, about 100 followers away from 20,000 on YouTube. Views are going up. We're very happy with where we are on YouTube. And we're very happy with where we are on this show. It is important anytime and every time I can get to you guys, I want to let you know. If you know someone that might enjoy the show, please tell them about it. Every day I have people reach out to me and tell me that they found the show for the first time. And I love that. As we know, if you're not growing, you're dying. Let's get into it, though. We don't waste any time here. Let's talk about La Madrina, the Black Widow, a.k.a. Griselda Blanco, on the sit-down. Griselda Blanco Restrepo was born February 15th, 1943, in the Colombian town of Cartagena. Cartagena is on the northern coast, really facing the Caribbean. It's actually a beautiful town. The problem for Griselda Blanco was she was born into a very rough environment. Her father, Fernando Blanco, deserted her and her mother basically at birth. And her mother, Ana Blanco, really was an awful mother. She was a prostitute. She was an alcoholic. She had issues with substance abuse. She had no steady work. And they lived in the slums of Cartagena. Now, for Ana Blanco, she decides when Griselda's 3 years old that she's just going to move to Medellin. She knew some people there. She was a hooker. She wasn't going to do anything for her daughter. She was abusive. And Griselda and her mother would move to Medellin. And look, this is where Griselda Blanco, at a very young age, basically her fate was decided for her. As we've talked about time and time and time again on this show, we're in our 67th episode, and probably about 65 of them, everybody's fate has been decided. They're born into stuff that really the only motivation is criminality around you, and you're decided on what you're going to do very early. By 9 or 10 years old, it was alleged that Griselda Blanco was a pickpocketer. She was a street thief. She was even selling her own body at basically not even a teenager. It was a old legend, and this had been something that was actually talked about by one of her lovers at one point. Griselda Blanco allegedly at the age of 11 kidnapped an individual, a small child from another area. It was said to be an upscale rich neighborhood, and the goal was by kidnapping this individual, she could contact his parents and attempt to get a ransom so she wouldn't kill him. Now, the parents balked and did not pay the ransom, and it was alleged that Griselda Blanco committed her first murder of that child at the age of 11 years old. She was a ruthless lunatic, really, from her early age. Now, for Griselda Blanco, as I said, she got into criminality very early, not just by murder. By 1954, really into the late 50s, she worked as a thief and a prostitute. She was a major pickpocketer. She also got into forging documents. And one of the things she started doing was forging phony immigration papers. And that's when she met an individual called Carlos Trujillo. Trujillo was a bit older than she was, but what he was an alcoholic, a drug addict, and a petty forger. And they felt like maybe they could create a lucrative business where they could, you know, sell phony passports and things of that nature. They would decide that really by the late 60s, Griselda Blanco decides that she's going to go to the United States, her and Trujillo. So by this time, they're dabbling a lot in just marijuana, low-level drugs, that sort of thing. She would illegally immigrate to the United States and start hanging out and settling in Queens. And that's where she would ultimately have three children with Mr. Trujillo. She would have three sons called Uber, Dixon, and Osvaldo. And we'll talk about their fates in just a little bit. Now, the thing for Griselda Blanco was, though, she wanted more. And one thing I've noticed about Blanco is she never seemed to have enough, right? So she realized quickly that Carlos Trujillo was never going to be much of anything. He was a bit of a deadbeat. She had bigger ideas, and she kind of understood that she was from Colombia. There was a lucrative cocaine trade. The coca leaf was big there, and she had direct connections. She ultimately meets a man called Alberto Bravo, and they begin selling cocaine together in the early 70s. Now, for her, she found out a very integral way to move cocaine. She decides that being a woman, she realizes that a bra has a ton of like little compartments. She would buy a business that sold undergarments, and she would move cocaine through the bras and girders that she was selling. And the good thing for Griselda was, is like I said, she had a lucrative connection that could take her straight into direct line to the finest and purest cocaine. She was cutting out the middleman, which was important. As we know, you know, the Italian mafia, the French connection, that sort of thing, that was a big hub for the drug trafficking waves in the 70s. But for her, she had a direct line into Colombia, into people like Fabio Ochoa and people of that nature. And that would set up down the road the very lucrative Medellin cartel. Now, remember, Pablo Escobar, who many people will say is the biggest drug trafficker in the history of the world, they wouldn't be lying. But Griselda Blanco was far ahead of where Pablo was. When Griselda Blanco began moving big amounts of cocaine, Pablo Escobar was a street thief. He was a car thief. She created the very lucrative, what we now know as a drug cartel. Her idea was, if we could have multiple people involved and we had multiple sources of supply, the pipeline would always be full. And the DEA would actually credit Griselda Blanco with, quote, being the modern day, basically throwing the motto out and gave to the rise to the modern day cartel. So she was kind of an innovator, if you will. Now, she would ultimately have her first husband killed, Carlos Trujillo. He would be killed. And interestingly enough, by 1975, the New York Police Department and the DEA would open a file on Griselda Blanco, and they would basically hit her with an indictment, her and her second husband. What happened was they had an operation called Operation Banshee, which was targeting Latin American drug traffickers. They would intercept 150 kilos of cocaine, and Griselda and Alfredo Bravo, they basically get word that an indictment's coming down. They flee to their native Colombia. Interestingly enough, it wouldn't take long before she got sick of Alberto Bravo. It was alleged that Griselda Blanco would hire hitmen to kill Bravo. It was alleged that he was stealing money, millions of dollars from her. And it was actually talked about that she actually pulled the trigger on her second husband. She pulled out a MAC-10 and shot him, basically. She was a very ruthless woman. She was learning the trade. She was making money. And she was becoming what she thought was the biggest drug trafficker in Colombia. That was her goal. She wanted to be very high level. Now, for her, she would continue to run her business in Colombia. And by this point, her three sons were very much learning the business. They knew nothing different as well. They were born into the same fate. This is how it works. It's like a domino effect. Now, in 1976, as we know, there was a bicentennial in the United States, 200 years. So nations were putting together, you know, ships and all sorts of things, and they were sending them to the United States to help celebrate. And that's exactly what Colombia did. They would send a ship called the Gloria into Miami and then up to New York. Now, Griselda Blanco, being in Colombia, had the bright idea to send couriers onto the ship and smuggle kilos of cocaine into Miami on the vessel. She was very smart. She was very much ahead of her time. Now, by the late 70s, Griselda Blanco would meet another individual. She would meet a man called Dario Sepulveda. Now, Sepulveda would end up being her third husband. Griselda Blanco was not good with men. Okay, it's pretty clear. She would ultimately have a son with Mr. Sepulveda, which we'll get into in just a little bit. Those two would move to Miami. They would illegally enter Miami. And I think it's important that we kind of go into what Miami was really in the 70s and into the 80s, because it was a complete change in what most of America knew as one of the safer cities in America. And quite frankly, a place that a lot of people wanted to go to. In the early 70s, Miami was a sleepy town. It was a big place, but it was for retirees. It was for families. It was a place where you could go and have a great vacation, right? It was somewhere where crime was low. People would sit out in South Beach with lawn chairs. And, you know, it was very quaint. It was very peaceful. It was like this beach oasis to hang out at. And the murder rates in the early 70s were very low. I mean, they were in the hundreds. I mean, in a city that big, you know, 100, 150 murders is very small. But what would ultimately happen is the mid-70s will come and go. By 1977, Jimmy Carter would become president of the United States. As we know, Jimmy Carter becomes president in 1977. He only serves 4 years. He was a terrible president. And one of Jimmy Carter's kind of messages, one of his whole ideas was he wanted to make everyone feel like they could come to this country and live the American dream, regardless of what it did to the country. He was all about humanization, being the guy that could save everybody. And he basically makes a terrible mistake. In 1980, Jimmy Carter decides to begin to accept Cuban immigrants that were exiling from Cuba, obviously, mass immigration. And ultimately what Fidel Castro did was he basically just rounded up all of the worst Cubans and said, okay, this guy, Jimmy Carter, will accept our bad people, and we're going to just send them all to America. We'll get them off our hands and we'll send them all to America. Now, the problem for the Carter administration was they didn't develop any response to like bringing these people in. Most of the refugees, and we'll get into the numbers in a second, were basically criminals. And a lot of people had a big issue with this because there was no documentation. You're seeing thousands of Cubans every day coming in. And it wasn't just Cubans. You would have Haitians, you would have Dominicans, you were having Colombians, you were having people that were really bad people coming into the United States. And the numbers are actually quite stark. This was only over a 6 month period. The refugees started coming in April of 1980. They would cease coming in on Halloween of 1980. So basically 6 months and 2 weeks, 6.5 months, basically.
Facebook is building tools to enhance safety and security. Over 40 million people are using Facebook's privacy checkup each month. That's nearly 60 times the population of Washington, D.C. Learn more about the work ahead at facebook.com/action.
During that time, 125,000 Cubans came in or immigrants came into the United States through the Mariel boat lift. Now, in May alone of that year, 86,000 immigrants came into this country from the Mariel boat lift. That was almost 70% of the people that came in 1 month. By April 25th, as many as 300 boats were picking up refugees in Mariel Harbor. And what was Fidel Castro saying? He basically said on camera that he was flushing the toilet of Cuba into Miami. And he made no bones about it. Most of the people that were coming over were criminals. Now, if you've ever seen Scarface, this is exactly how Scarface begins. Tony Montana is Marilito, basically, which is what they called these individuals that were coming over. And it's really quite amazing how many of them were actually criminals, basically. You look at the dispersal of percentages of how many bad people came over. Okay, so 125,000 refugees in all came. According to a Miami Sun Sentinel article in 1985, they would allege that 16 to 20,000 of those immigrants were criminals. Now, you had child molesters, rapists, thieves, burglars, drug dealers, murderers. And at one point in the 1985 report, about 400 Marielito Cubans were reported to inhabit Dade County jails on a typical day. Per day. Think about that. Now, what does this do to crime? Okay. And it's quite amazing. So as I said before, in like early 70s, the murder rate in Miami was like 150 a year. In 1980, which was the year of the Mariel boat lift, 573 homicides. In 1981, 621 homicides. Think about that. That's basically almost 1,300 homicides in 2 years. Now, do we think it's just random that this would coalesce with the Mario Boatlift? Now, two economists, Alexander Billy and Michael Packard, would estimate that the effects of the refugees and the crime in Miami, they would find evidence of an increase in both violent and property crime. And they would argue that costs were relatively minor and driven by a combination of factors, including very poor oversight by authorities. They would also conclude that the rise in crime could have been avoided. It does not justify current fears surrounding migration, which is true. But we have to admit, the federal oversight of this was not particularly good. And it never is when it comes to illegal immigration for the most part. Now, what it also did was it killed the labor market, right? So Miami was this hub for, you know, tourism, and everyone wanted to put a business there. It completely was destroyed. At one point, it was said that in 1981, Miami would be labeled as the most violent city in America. What you started to have is cocaine cowboys doing whatever they wanted to do. And most of the people that were turning up dead were Latin Americans, mostly Cuban descent, Colombian descent, Latin American descent. Now, what really hurt Miami was a Time magazine article where it basically called out, how bad it was. A cover would come out from Time magazine with South Florida, and the question would be "Paradise Lost?" And they went into this long soliloquy about how Miami was a complete mess. You would see journalists going to stories with guns on their hip. I mean, old women had guns. Everyone had guns. The labor markets had guns. Everyone had guns. So what Miami does is they have a major issue on their hands. And keep in mind, Griselda Blanco had really even gotten in totally to all her business. And we'll get back to her in a second and how she kind of relates to all this. But I wanted to give you a picture of what Miami looked like. Now, Miami would ultimately create, and this would be created by a guy called Raul Diaz. Raul Diaz was a homicide detective. Miami had its own issues with corruption, and they would clean house in the late 70s. Diaz would be a new homicide detective they would bring in, one of the most illustrious that they had in the police department at the time. He would come up with an idea called CENTAC, which would stand for Central Tactical. And what it was it was an initiative that was federally funded. It was an elite unit that included members of the Miami Police Department and the Drug Enforcement Agency. And the goal was, it was only supposed to deal with solving these drug-related homicides, because, you know, 85-90% of these homicides were drug-related. And the goal was, first, getting rid of the people that are perpetrating these crimes, and B, getting rid of the people ordering these crimes, the drug traffickers. Now, the problem that the CENTAC would have and all these other officers would have is it was even difficult to identify these individuals, because most of them had multiple passports, multiple identities. They were violent, particularly violent individuals, very violent felons, and they had no issue because they were tough. They were from Cuba. They had lived life as, just mostly in poverty. What they loved as well was machine guns. It was very much a common theme in Miami of homicide by MAC-10 or MAC-11. So what did the CENTAC do? They bought machine guns. They started lifting up what they were doing. Now, I want to talk a little bit about one of the chief hitters that Griselda Blanco would ultimately meet up with. In 1969, an individual called Jorge Ayala would come to the United States from Colombia. In July of 1969, he would settle in Chicago. And what Ayala would become was a very lethal car thief. He was a very good car thief. Ultimately, he began working for an individual running guns into Miami. He was making $5,000 per load. And in 1979, he would ultimately move to Miami. His job eventually would be protecting stash houses, drug stash houses, moving drugs and weapons. And he would ultimately get a job as an enforcer, taking care of people. He proved to be a very skilled hitter. And he got a job at one point where he screwed it up. He was supposed to kill two brothers. Ultimately, he'd be called upon by a woman that wanted to speak to him about fucking up the hit. She got him in the backseat of a car, and she basically says, look, we didn't have very much shot at this guy, these two guys, and you just fucked it up. You got to fix this. she would tell him at that point, the woman would be Griselda Blanca. She would tell him at that point, look, do what you got to do. I don't care if there are people around. You got to do this. This needs to be done. Spray the whole table up if you see him at a club. And that's what we'll get into, Griselda's obsession with killing people and the fact that she really didn't care who was involved. And that's why the murder rate became so high. By the early 80s, bodies are piling up around Miami. As I said, almost 1,200, 1,300 in 2 years. And she would make great use of killing. She would establish a group of hitters called the Pistoleros, and they would include her chief hitter, Jorge Ayala. It was said that she would kill anybody. It didn't matter who you were. If you were a lover of her, she got scorned by. Maybe you messed with somebody that she enjoyed. It didn't matter. If she didn't want to pay you on something, she would just kill you. So let's say you owed her, she owed you $2 million. Instead of paying you, she'd just kill you. She didn't care. And for her, it was no witness, no crime. She had no issue with going into a strip mall parking lot, seeing a target, and just spraying. Didn't matter who hit, who got hit. Now, the chief method that would be established by Griselda Blanco was drive-by motorcycle. Pull up on a motorcycle, spray somebody up, and ride away. Now, we've also seen this in, if you follow Italian organized crime, particularly in Italy, in Naples, the Camorra is big on death by moped, pulling a moped up to a group, spraying it, and flying away. Now, as we know with a motorcycle, it's very easy to maneuver in and out of traffic and get into tight squeezes. Cars a little bit more difficult. As we know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, cars were a lot bigger than they are now. They're not a lot of compact cars back then. Now, all this really would start, this would really start the drug scene moving in a wild direction. And this was really where I think we first started understanding who Griselda was. On July 11th, 1979, Griselda Blanca would order both Jorge Ayala and another hitter of hers, Paco Sepulveda, to a strip mall called the Dadeland Mall. They would set up outside a liquor store called Crown Liquors. And they would have a panel van with the words Happy Time Complete Party Supply on the side. And the goal was when they see their target, the truck would rise up and they'd run out and just take care of who they needed to kill. Now, the individual they were trying to kill that day was a man called Carlos Pinello Ramirez. Not Carlos Pinello Ramirez. He was feuding with the guy they were looking to kill, a man called German Panesso. German Panesso was a drug kingpin in Miami. He was doing business with this guy, Pinello Ramirez, and Griselda Blanco. Now, during that day, Panesso, who the target was, he was there with his bodyguard, a man called Juan Carlos Hernandez. So the goal was, when you spot Panesso, take him out. Under no circumstance. Now, what was so wild about this was it's believed that Blanco owed Panesso a substantial amount of money and she didn't want to pay it back. She would side with her friend, Pinello Ramirez, and say, look, I hate this motherfucker. I owe him money. I'll back you. Let's just get rid of him. And that's exactly what happened. In the afternoon, it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on July 11, 1979, Ayala and Sepulveda run at the Crown Liquor Store after they spot Panesso and Hernandez. At that point with MAC-10s, they spray the liquor store. Now, both were killed and two store employees were wounded in the attack as well. It was a very brazen attack. They'd ultimately leave the van and escape. Now, inside the van, they would find a treasure trove of weapons, MAC-10s, handguns, shotguns, all sorts of stuff. They would basically have whatever they needed. This was a legit hit. This was a choreographed hit. And this is the kind of thing that Griselda Blanco was doing. She had no regard for anybody. She was not going to allow her fortune, which we'll talk about in a second, to be affected. No body, no crime. Now, we can't go into every murder that Griselda was a part of. Look, obviously she killed her lovers. She would have people killed by ordering it. But one of the things that Griselda was also very involved in was just wild partying and things of that nature. She would, quote, host very odd sex orgies. She very much loved men and women. She enjoyed partaking in both. She would have young females that worked for her, and they would also have sex with her. She'd also developed an addiction to bazooka. Now, bazooka is cocaine, basically, but it's the paste at the bottom of the barrel of the cocoa leaf. And using it is particularly toxic, right? It's something that can give you just a significantly better high than actually just cocaine. And it's something that really is particularly horrific for you. It actually derives from the Spanish word for trash, basura. And it would be basuco. It would translate into dirty trash. And it's very common in Colombia. A lot of the farmers do it. And what it does is it gives you really just enhanced cocaine effects. But it does create a high that gives you the increased energy and the talkativeness, but it gives you the sociability, the confidence. But it's particularly bad for you, really bad for you. It contains all sort of awful things, ethanol, sulfuric acid, chloroform, benzoic acid, kerosene, all sorts of bad things. It's unrefined and unpurified as well. And it can be smoked, interestingly enough. She started partaking in that. And as we know, you never get high on your own supply. So what happens was a woman begins hanging out. She was a drug dealer, Rociela Gomez. Now, Rociela Gomez was younger. She was very attractive. She begins to have some sort of relationship with a woman that, or sorry, with a man that Griselda Blanco was involved in. And she basically orders Rociela Gomez killed. She sends two hitters after Gomez. Gomez believes, as she's driving her Corvette, she believes that she's being followed. She pulls up to a light in Miami and abandons her car. She finds a group that bring her in and basically say they'll give her a ride. She's scared for her life. At that point, though, she's too slow. Two gunmen walk up to the car, light her up in the backseat. She would kill anybody. It didn't matter what they did to her. She killed everybody. Pretty simple. A couple other very notorious homicides involving not only Griselda, but involving Jorge Ayala, her top enforcer. In 1982, Ms. Blanco would order Ayala to kill a man called Jesus Castro, who used to work for Griselda, but at one point he had fucked up a drug supply deal. He was supposed to watch a drug supplier, but he didn't carry out an order. And he also, it was alleged that he started talking badly about one of Griselda's kids. Now that was a no-no. On February 6, 1982, Mr. Ayala would locate Mr. Castro alongside another hitter called Miguelito Perez. They would pull up to Castro's vehicle in Miami and had stopped at a red light. They take out a silenced machine gun and spray the car. The problem was they miss Castro and kill his two-year-old son who was in the car. Now, Ayala would ultimately be charged in the murder of Castro's son down the road, which we'll get to. Also, on orders from Griselda Blanco, Mr. Ayala and some of his crew would kill a couple called Alfredo and Grizel Lorenzo in their Miami home in May of 1982, just several months after the Castro killing. Now, this group, this couple, they were buying drugs off of Blanco, particularly on consignment, didn't pay her back, and Griselda ordered them killed. Now, that goal by Griselda was she would often say, if you go into a house and there are cats, kids, goldfish, doesn't matter, kill everyone in the house. Now, on this point, Ayala walked into the home, but he did not kill everyone in the house. He would not kill the children, which were in the house. But Alfredo and Griselda Lorenzo were killed that day. It was also alleged that Griselda would order him to kill up to 11 members of a gang in New York City in 1981. And he would also be killed. He would also kill many others for Griselda Blanco, including six people in a home in Miami in the early 80s as well. Four men, two women. So when we look at how many people Griselda killed, I don't know if we'll ever truly know, but it was in the hundreds probably. It's actually alleged that between Colombia and the United States, the governments in both countries would allege that she killed and had people, up to 300 people killed during her time in control. Now for Griselda Blanco, she was enjoying the fruits of her labor. At this point, it was discussed that Griselda was earning estimates of $80 million a month. So when we think about how much money that is, that's just south of, via 30 days in a month, that's just south of like $3 million a day. That's a ton of fucking money. And look, back then in Miami, there were banks everywhere. Everybody was making money in the drug trade, and she was buying everything. She loved partying. She enjoyed big homes. She had a mansion in Miami Beach. She had luxury cars. She had jets. As I said, she had these wild sex orgies. Her kids had whatever they wanted. She was the shit, basically. There was no other ways to say it. The problem, though, she had been a target of not only the DEA dating back to 1975, but she was now a major target of CENTAC and Miami police. Now, the one thing that we can take from Griselda Blanco was she loved killing people. She just didn't care. As I said, you get in the way, you get dealt with. It's pretty simple. Now, one issue that she started to have was not only did the feds and the state want her, but other traffickers started to want to kill her as well. At one point in early 1984, Griselda starts worrying that she's going to be killed. I mean, there were hits put out on her. She started muddying up the waters in Colombia. At one point, it was alleged that she was trying to kill members of the Medellin cartel. And that was a major issue, obviously. So she believes that she's got to get out of Miami. So she flees to California, and she would live in Irvine, Orange County in California. Now, I do want to discuss the final husband that she had, Darius Sepulveda. They would have a child in the late 70s. Griselda would name it Michael Corleone Blanco. It was said that she loved The Godfather, and she would name her son after the very famous character played by Al Pacino. Now, in late 1983, Darius Sepulveda made a disastrous mistake. He decides that he wants to flee and go to Colombia, and he takes young Michael with him. Griselda is furious, has him killed. So that's now three husbands that Griselda Blanco has whacked. I guess you have to wonder why people began to date Griselda Blanco. It was never going to end well. She has now killed three of her husbands. Now, she would flee to Irvine, California. And what would happen is federal officials started to realize that they weren't far off from her track, basically. And the DEA started closing in. In fact, in May of 1984, an individual in the DEA, Bob Palumbo, would actually spot Griselda Blanco in Redondo Beach, California. He would spot her trading off money with a federal informant. So the government was closing in on Miss Blanco. Now, by this point, three of her sons were very much involved with the drug trade as well. And they would meet very sad ends, which we'll get to in a bit. Now, in early 1985, February exact, the DEA would finally close in on Griselda Blanco. She would be arrested on February 17th, 1985. Now, interestingly enough, she would give a false name, but the DEA had obviously known who they had been looking for a decade. It was said that Bob Palumbo would say that he would actually see Griselda Blanco on multiple occasions and that she looked starkly different from the woman that he had known about 10 years previous. She was a lot more haggard looking. She looked a lot older. She looked like any other, you know, mother or grandmother, basically. She was a lot more elderly looking, if you will. And the government had found their woman. Now, the trial for Griselda Blanco would start in 1985. And the trial really centered around really just one informant, basically. They had one witness that they were depending on was the Southern District. They were looking at one individual, a man called Carmen Caban. Now, Carmen Caban had been working for Griselda Blanco. He worked for her in the early 70s and was a main counterpoint to her organization. Now, she was facing federal drug trafficking charges as well as conspiracy. That's what the government hits you with, conspiracy. That's always going to be. That's the whole, we don't have to catch you with drugs, but if we know that you're talking about drugs, it won't matter. So Caban would testify at length about between the operations of 1972 to 1975 and of the cocaine importing ring in which Blanco allegedly participated in. Now, on the cross-examination of Caban, Blanco's defense would inquire about Caban's cooperation agreement with the government and that he had a grant of immunity for his past crimes. Now, the counsel also inquired about Caban's extensive career as a drug dealer and that her many past acts of lying, stealing, and defrauding. However, the judge in the case, Judge Candela, would prevent defense counsel from asking Caban about her alleged participation in a murder. So, again, the government doesn't need to hit you with any, they don't have to find you with drugs, but if they know that you're conspiring to sell drugs, they can get you. Now, ultimately, a lot of this had to do as well with the prosecution introducing evidence of the arrest in 1972 of an individual called Antonio Romero, who was caught at Kennedy Airport trying to smuggle cocaine to the United States, sealing it into a dog cage. Now, Judge Cannell would explain that to find Blanco guilty of conspiracy, the jury had to find four elements: an agreement, an overt act, a violation of the law, and her knowing participation. Now, the judge would respond, it may be that you don't find there's conspiracy at all, or there is a number of conspiracies rather than one conspiracy, because the government must provide here that there's one conspiracy, namely that the drugs were gotten in Colombia, brought into Miami or other places, and then brought to New York. This is the conspiracy that is charged. Now, beyond a reasonable doubt, the government would find the ability to do that. And in November of 1985, the jury would reach a verdict. She'd be found guilty. And the federal government would give Griselda Blanco 15 years in federal prison. Now, for the government, I think there was more of a thought that, you know, they were only really getting her on drug trafficking. You're probably thinking to yourself, she killed, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 people. How does she only get 15 years? Because there were no murders in this indictment. They hit her with 15. She's going to do 80%. She'll do 11, 12 years. Nothing. By this point, Griselda Blanco, she's in her 40s. She's not old. She'll be out by 55. The problem was, Griselda Blanco was going to have to face at some point Miami-Dade County in the state of Florida. She would get 15 years and report to the Federal Correctional Institution at Dublin in California, a woman's federal prison. Now, weirdly enough, I want to talk a little bit about, before we get into the state case that would involve Griselda Blanco. In 1992, an individual called Charles Crosby, who was a small-time cocaine dealer in Oakland, California, would write a letter to Griselda Blanco in federal prison. And they would actually strike up a correspondence. And within 6 months, they were very involved. They were a couple. There would be multiple pictures at Dublin with Griselda, posing with Mr. Crosby. And basically within 6 months, they fell in love. She would give him millions of dollars. He was placed in control of what little she had left in the drug game. she fell quick. And if you've ever seen Cocaine Cowboys 2, you know who Mr. Crosby is. Now, in 1994, Griselda, upon her release, would have to face another indictment. The state of Florida would try to hem her up on multiple murders. And they felt like they had a slam dunk case. And they really thought they had a slam dunk case once they were able to flip her old friend, Jorge Ayala. Now, any drug trafficker knows once they flip your hitter, you're done. And if we think back to the Cabani Savage episode, Cabani knew it. If you are involved in drug trafficking and you are killing people, if they flip the hitter, you're fucked because he is going to roll it all up to you. And they felt like the governor, the state felt like they had enough to put Griselda away for life. Now, the issue that they had was, and it was a fairly large one, the whole case was about Ayala's credibility, right? Because they had no witnesses. They really didn't have any evidence. They had no ballistics. They had no fingerprints. Mr. Ayala, on immunity, basically said, look, I killed for her. These are who I killed. And this is when I was told to do it, and this is when I did it. He would tell a story. Now, again, it was all about his credibility, his word. Because once you crush his credibility, the case is destroyed. So the government had to worry because they were dealing with a pretty, let's be honest, violent individual and a sociopath. So they had to do some due diligence here, but then they had to worry, is this guy going to do something stupid while he's locked up and fuck our case? And guess what? That's exactly what happened. Jorge Ayala would basically fuck everything up. He would begin having relationships with multiple members of secretaries that worked in the state's attorney's office. He would change money and cash orders for phone sex inside a prison. And it destroyed the case. It's that simple. Ultimately, they would have to make a plea deal, cut a deal with Griselda Blanco in 1998. And Griselda's lawyers basically said, look, we don't want to go to trial on this. We don't want to chance it. What are you going to do for us? They gave her 10 years. She had already served three. So pretty much she was going to get out in 2004. Upon her release, she would be deported. That was the goal. Now for Mr. Ayala, he would screw everything up. In 1993, he would plead guilty to three murders and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, with the possibility of parole after 25 years. Now, when we look at Mr. Ayala, he was actually featured in Cocaine Cowboys 1, still in prison. Now, if he is ever released, Mr. Ayala will be deported to Colombia. Now, as far as I know, Mr. Ayala is still in prison. I have not looked at the Florida Department of Corrections in a while. I guess I could do that right now as we speak. See, this is what I do, folks. I do all this right away. I don't need to wonder. Let's just do it now. Let's figure it out. Let's see if we have anything here. I don't know if I can get this right now. I'm going to try to search for it. Please specify. What do we specify? I did. I specified. No aliases. But as far as I know, Mr. Ayala is still in prison. We think of it 1993. I'm going to guess he probably didn't get parole after 25 years. Now, if he ever gets released, as I said, he will be deported to Colombia. Now, for Griselda Blanco, she would be released from prison in 2004 and we deported back to Colombia. Now, interestingly enough, during her later life in prison, it was said that she had mellowed out. In her older age, she began reading the Bible. And according to her son, who also became a devout Christian, Miss Blanco became very involved with her religion. She would move back to Colombia and lived a very nondescript life for the most part. It was said that she lived very openly in a suburb of Medellin called Belin. And she was very much respected, well-respected, quite frankly. It was also said that Miss Blanco was very benevolent to the poor. She had known what it was like to be poor. Remember, she had grown up in an awful place, a place that she was benevolent to those people. And she was always known to give to homeless and to take care of street people. Now, as we know, Griselda had many enemies. In 2012, at the age of 69, Griselda Blanco would leave a butcher shop in Medellin. Upon her release from the butcher shop, she walked down a path and a gunman would pull up to her on a motorcycle and shoot her twice in the head. And she would die in a pool of blood outside the butcher shop. Yep, she died just like she had mastered a member many years ago in the 80s. That was her main method of killing people. And she met the same fate in 2012. She would die at the age of 69 years old. Now, interestingly enough, her three sons, Uber, Dixon, and Osvaldo, would all die in Colombia in related drug murders. Now, the only member of the Griselda Blanco tree to be still alive is actually her son, her youngest son, Michael Corleone Blanco. He is 43 years old. And interestingly enough, he has an Instagram. He has a clothing line called Puro Blanco. He is on a reality show called Cartel Crew on VH1. And he's been able to make some money through his mother, basically. It's also been talked about that he is very actively shopping a film about his mother. And I have to admit, it would be incredible as long as they do it right. It's said that Jennifer Lopez will be playing Miss Blanco. I have to admit, she seems a little attractive to play Griselda. But in essence, I think it'll be a great film regardless of what happens. Look, the truth of the matter is, when we look back on female criminals, I'm not sure if we can find a criminal worse than Miss Blanco. She is an awful, ruthless person who really polluted this country with thousands of kilos of cocaine and other illicit drugs. She was a ruthless murderer. She was someone who belongs in the gates of hell, and she met the end that she deserved. It's very simple. When we look at drug trafficking, she is an originator, though. She's a trailblazer. Nobody did what she did. She was the first to do it. Without her, I don't know if we have as a successful Pablo Escobar. I'm sure it would have happened eventually. However, she was doing it far before anybody else. And that's one thing when we're looking at who Griselda was. She was an awful, awful individual. In my estimation, the most violent female drug trafficker in the history of the world, quite frankly. But we have to say, in one essence, she was a trailblazer in drug trafficking. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review. Let us know what you think. We'll be back next week with another great episode. I think we're going to do something on Philadelphia next week. I guess we'll have to wait and see. I'll have to decide. But I think Philly will be on the menu next week. Maybe we'll do some Joey Molino, Ron Previty stuff, I think. But like I said, go follow us on Twitter. You can get all the updates on the show and what we have going on. If we ever do Q&As, you can find all that there. Go check us out on YouTube as well. Just search the Sit Down to Mafia Street podcast. And please do me a favor, support all our sponsors. I do some live reads for different companies. Check all that stuff out. I use it. Testimonials are real. So thank you all for listening this week. As always, I appreciate you. We'll see you next week here on the Sit Down.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.